Right, brethren, as we've just commented a moment or two back, today is the Passover season. We're still in the Feast of Unleavened Bread for another two or three days. And at this time of the year, it's quite traditional, I think quite proper, to look back on the initial exodus of Israel from Egypt as they set off on that night, to be much remembered, with a joyful hand, a high hand, heading for the Promised Land. It was a great time. A time of rejoicing. And there's many, many lessons that we can learn as we look back to ancient Israel and their journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. That's what we're going to do today. The message is entitled, Lessons from the Wilderness. Lessons from the Wilderness. I've spoken about this topic at least a couple of times before, but I find the events that we're looking at actually quite fascinating. I do enjoy reviewing them myself, and so you may have heard it before, but hopefully you won't mind reviewing them again, because I think there's a great deal here for us to look into. If we open our Bibles, first of all, at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10, and we'll read verses 1 to 13. So 1 Corinthians 10, we won't pick up the previous chapter, but Paul had been talking about, running in a race, keeping your body disciplined, and you should run your race to get to the end of it, to win the prize. And then he points out in chapter 10, where we're going, that actually, in a sense, ancient Israel didn't stay in the race. They didn't get to the end of the course. They wandered off the course, and they failed to complete the course, which is something that you and I obviously should not be doing. So we pick up in verse 1 of chapter 10. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So Paul's referring back to ancient Israel. The Passover had taken place. They were now free from Pharaoh, free from the taskmasters, free from slavery, and now they're heading off. And all of them left behind Moses. All of them went through the Red Sea and, in a sense, were baptized. All of them. That sounds good. All of them. They've all left Egypt. They're all heading to the Promised Land, God's kingdom. But, verse 5, but with most of them, with the majority of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. In fact, only two adults ended up in the kingdom, just Joshua and Caleb. So of all we just read about, all of them, only two made it into the kingdom. Verse 6, now these things became our examples to the intent that we believers, we Christians, should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So Paul makes it very plain what happened to ancient Israel after they left Egypt. Their adventures, so to speak, in the wilderness, the lessons from the wilderness, these things are our examples. They are to teach us so that we don't make the same mistakes that they made. And Paul says us believers, we Christians, that we shouldn't do the same things they did. It says here, we should not lust after evil things. Lust, we sometimes think of as just applying to sexual desires, but actually the word simply means a strong craving or coveting. And all of us at times can covet, strongly desire things that we shouldn't be playing with. Verse 7, and we should not become idolaters. We believers, we Christians, we church members, we should not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And we'll read that particular verse when we get to it. nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell or died. It's quite a lot in one day of those that left Egypt with a high hand. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Well, would we tempt Jesus the Lord? Well, Paul says he doesn't want us to, but that sort of implies that we could do. Verse 10, nor murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, we'll see plenty of murmuring in a few moments when we get to the scriptures. Other translations are, don't grumble, don't murmur, don't be discontented, because that's essentially what it means. You're murmuring or grumbling because you're not happy. You want more, better, higher, whiter, cleaner, different. And so you murmur and grumble and complain. And Paul says we should not do that. Now, that's probably going to be one of the sort of areas we slip into most easily. And, of course, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, we're talking about putting leaven out. So an attitude of being discontented, always grumbling, always complaining about your lot in life, that potentially is what's in vision here. Verse 11, in case we missed the point, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. So Paul's quite blunt. It's written down for our benefit, for our admonition, our instruction, or it can be translated for our warning. Because Paul's saying, let's not do this and let's not do that and let us not follow that example which they did. So Paul obviously thinks it's possible that believers can do some pretty silly things, and he wants us to learn the lessons from the wilderness. Verse 12, and just in case you think you're above that, Paul says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Don't be too sure. Maybe we have matured. You know, maybe we are individually quite strong. Maybe we won't make these mistakes. We shouldn't. But Paul's just saying, just be a bit careful. Don't just jump to the conclusion that, well, I've been around the church 40 years. I'm safe. Never happened to me. Paul says, well, just be cautious. Just, you know, take heed, because maybe you're not quite as strong as you think. Verse 13, no temptation, can be translated test or trial. No temptation, test or trial has overtaken you except such as is common to man. There's nothing unique about the difficulties you and I face, whether it's financial or health or to deal with families, you know, co-workers, where we live. Everything's relatively common to mankind, but God is faithful. And that's probably the biggest mistake that Israel made. They never understood that God is faithful. Time after time after time and again after time, they failed to understand God. But you know, I should do better. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted, tested, or tried beyond what you're able. But with the temptation, test, or trial, will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. So what we're going to do is, you know, look at the lessons from the wilderness, see some of these mistakes, errors, wrong directions they took, look at them relatively briefly, but the idea is going to be these were written down for our admonition, so let's see if anything among them looks at all similar to what we might be doing, and if that is the case, hopefully we learn. And learn not to do that. Let's look at Numbers chapter 14. Numbers 14. And read verses 19 to 24. Numbers 14. The book of Numbers was written by Moses, who of course was there with the Israelites. First-hand witness of what took place. And we'll pick up in verses 19 to 24. And we'll come back to this passage, I think, a bit later in its chronology. But this is the end of a particular difficult period, and God's not very happy with the Israelites at this point. And he's pretty much said to Moses, step out of the way. I'm going to bring this to an end. And Moses intervenes and says, verse 19, pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt, even until now. In these preceding several months. Then the Lord said, okay, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. And Joshua was included too, Joshua and Caleb. But notice that verse 22, God says here, these people have put me to the test. They have provoked me 10 times since we left Egypt. 10 times. And this was the 10th and final time. And we come to this part of the story later. We can see that God decides that he has to really change the plan. He can't continue. So 10 times. Now, some people say the number 10 is just a sort of, just means a lot. But others point out there are, it seems, 10 occasions, which we will now look at, where you can see that once, twice, three, four, five, all the way up to 10 times, that the people basically challenge God, express doubt about God, impugn rather bad motives to God. So on 10 occasions, it seems, they provoked God. And eventually he had to decide that, ultimately, I cannot work with these people. Already, in just something like 2 or 3 months, they've provoked me 10 times. This is not going to work the way I'd originally desired. So we're going to look at these 10 occasions, 10 incidents, these 10 times, and to see what we might learn. Let's look at the first one. So the first time they tested God as they left with a high hand, we find in Exodus 14, and we read a few of the verses from 5 to 31. Exodus 14. You remember the Exodus took place in chapter 12. This is just immediately after that. Exodus 14. And we pick up in verse 5. Just shortly after they'd left with a high hand. It was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? Well, because if you look round out his window, he'd seen the entire country was devastated. You know, flies and lightning and fire and diseases and dead cattle and locusts and the firstborn all just being buried. Pretty obvious why they let Israel go. They couldn't take much more punishment. But, you know, the mind plays tricks, so he made ready his chariot and took his people with him to chase after Israel. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. So the elite, 600, the top charioteers, plus other chariots. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out, or had gone out, with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, not just the 600 chariots, also the army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth before Baal-zephon. Now the Jewish historian, Mr. Josephus, who wrote round about 50, 60, 70, 80 AD thereabouts, his information was that there were the 600 elite chariots, 50,000 horsemen, and 200,000 in the army. So you're talking of a quarter of a million trained military men heading off after, you know, old women, old men, children, flocks and herds, and people who had been just slaves up until a few days earlier. Looking at verse 10, "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us alone, that we may serve, be slaves to the Egyptians"? For it would have been better to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness.'" So it hasn't taken very long for Israel to start doubting God, and accusations here that you burst out to kill us. Well, did they not witness 10 plagues strike Egypt? Didn't they, you know, remain secure under the blood of the Lamb when the firstborn of Egypt was killed? Haven't they seen just how much power God wields? Is there any reason particularly to be frightened out here in reality, saying, well, hang on, you know, God has destroyed the empire. I wonder what he'll do now. I wonder how he'll take care of us now. I wonder how he'll destroy the Egyptian armies now. Well, this will be curious. But you don't see that. Immediately they give in. We wanted to stay there in slavery. You've dragged us out here to kill us. We're going to die. We're going to die. Oh, we're doomed. We're doomed. Not much faith there. Not much trust in God there. And you might say it's early on, and I accept it is, but, you know, they've witnessed some really remarkable signs, and at the first little challenge, they're melting. Like, what do they say?
Chocolate
Christians. When the heat's on, they melt. And, of course, we can see probably a little lesson here for us. Once we start out in God's way, it doesn't necessarily become super-duper easy with red carpets rolled out for us. Sometimes we had problems. Panic, give in. Oh, I wish I'd never been called. I didn't expect to have to lose my job over the Sabbath, or wherever it might be. Is there any trust in God, any faith in God, any belief in God? Well, not here. There wasn't. So moving on, verse 13. "And Moses said to the people, 'Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace.'" So there's some sort of confidence there. That's the attitude that you and I ought to have. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward.'" Because that's awkward. Because in the north, where they were, they're in a sort of like a sort of plain or a valley. To the north is mountains. To the south is mountains. You can't go over either. To the one side of you, to the west, is a quarter million armed men with big sharp swords, big sharp spears. And the other side of you, there's the Red Sea. So actually, apart from going up in the air, you know, beam me up, Scotty, there's nowhere else to go. It's like we're trapped. That's why, of course, they were panicking. You couldn't even run. But God says, verse 16, "Lift up your rod and stretch it. Stretch your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen, the lot. And then the Egyptians, the ones back home, I guess, will know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one," that's to Egypt, which is all obscure, dark and foggy and you couldn't see anything, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided, which you just read over, of course, but that's some miracle. There's indications the Red Sea was about 8 miles across at this point, and, quite deep, and it's going to make the waters stand up on one side and the other and create a dry channel that you can walk over. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. I wouldn't. Thinking I realize by now this is not going to work out very well. There's ruin back home. All the crops have been eaten up by locusts and burned up by fire and so on. The firstborn, and probably many, many of these people had lost relatives as the firstborn. But I guess if Pharaoh drives you forward, you go. So in they went. Now it came to pass in the morning watch, that's the late night leading up to dawn, so probably about 4 o'clock in the morning our time, the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. He took off their chariot wheels. So they drove with difficulty. Well, I don't think you would. I think it's probably only 2 wheels in a chariot. If you take them both off, I'm not sure you drive at all. Apart from just scraping along. Not pleasant. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel. For the Lord, Jehovah, in other words, fights for them against the Egyptians," which you'd have thought they knew already. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, when the light dawned, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Be horses and military men of all sorts, army and cavalry, just lying there, bloating on the seaside. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, and so the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Sounds good, at least sort of momentarily. Of course, as we know, it's not going to last very long, but at this point, you've just seen potentially, if Josephus was right, a 250,000 army wiped out. You've not had to fight in the slightest. The sea has opened up. You've walked through it. They followed you in. There are a lot of problems there. Couldn't see where they were going. Obscurity, wheels coming off the wagon, so to speak. And then the waters cascade down on them, and they're all drowned.
I didn't think it.
And that's great. And so they believe God. They believe Jehovah's out for us. Didn't believe it, a few hours ago, but now we've seen the evidence. We believe in God, and we believe that this mighty man Moses is his servant, and wow, we're off to the promised land. So that's the first test. Remember initially, why have you brought us out here to kill us in the wilderness? Why couldn't we have stayed back in slavery? Why do you interrupt our great lives as slaves, Moses? So, their doubts haven't gone very far, actually. Let's look at the second time they provoked God, the second time they tested God, chapter 15, verses 22 to 27. Doesn't say a huge amount here explicitly, but you can read between the lines, I think, and pick up the problems. Verse 22, so Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea after that wonderful victory, and then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days. in the wilderness and found no water. So not a lot of time has elapsed, has it? They've come to this area and gone 3 days into it, and there's no water there. And they came to Marah, verse 23. They could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. You just couldn't, you know, there was water there, apparently. We tried sipping it, and it just looked, ugh, disgusting. Can't drink that. Can't give that to our cattle and flocks and our children. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink, you?" Now, you might have thought they'd have said, "Well, hang a second. We've just seen the mighty works and signs of Jehovah God. He's bringing us to the promised land. We can trust him. We've learned that lesson. We're slow learners, but we know it. And here we are, water's in short supply, but this fantastic God, Jehovah, let's just look to him and see what he's going to do." But they didn't. They murmured. They grumbled against Moses. "Where's the water, Moses?" Murmur, murmur, grumble, grumble. There's no gratitude anywhere here. No apparent trust in God. Didn't see God. They just thought there's no water. And so it says they murmured, but I think we can understand what that means if you were there. There'd be a lot of murmuring, a lot of grumbling, a lot of complaining, a lot of whispering, a lot of nasty things being said about Moses behind his back. Because you know what Israelites are like, because you know, we all share a similar approach much of the time. Verse 25, "So Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet." So God can deal with this. It's not a problem. And perhaps this is the final time that Israel provokes God, because now they were whinging, they were moaning, they were murmuring, but now suddenly Moses finds his tree, and you just take the tree and you toss it into these bitter waters, and the waters become lovely, fresh, refreshing, beautiful. Oh, clear water, fantastic. Well, that's it. We doubted God slightly, but now we've learned our lesson. This is test two. And we know how many there were up until the end of this particular episode. Verse, carrying on. "There he, God, made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them and said, 'If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you.'" That's actually in the Hebrew, it's "I am Jehovah Rapha." That's my name. I am Jehovah Rapha. I am your God healer. So God's presenting himself to them as, you know, one who has already delivered them, actually multiple times, who's providing for them right now in terms of giving them fresh water to drink and for their flocks and herds. And also he says, "Oh, by the way, I'm your healer. You know, any sickness, any disease that comes your way, I will heal. You can look to me. You can trust me. I am Jehovah, and I'm your healer." And so God's trying to get a message across, and you might think, well, that's it. Yep, okay. God's just announced he's their covenant healer. Wow, these people surely by now have got the message. Well, let's read chapter 16, and verse 1. "And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt." So they departed on the 15th day of the first month, so here, you know, about a month has elapsed. Verse 2, "And then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron," oh, he's involved now as well, "in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord,'" oops, "'in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness area to kill this whole assembly with hunger.'" Now, that doesn't say a lot for these people. because now they're accusing Moses, and apparently Aaron as well, and surely they knew that Moses was God's spokesman. I think they'd seen plenty of evidence of that, so really it was essentially blaming God, but perhaps they didn't quite want to go that far, you know, in words explicitly. But if you're blaming the man that God has appointed and anointed and sent for you, and whom God has backed up multiple times, and you're more or less saying, you know, you brought us out here to kill us and starve us to death, you scumbag. Oh, back in Egypt when we had pots of meat, you know, fresh, lovely meat, rich off the bone, bread to the full, real food. I mean, what are they looking at? I mean, they're just, you know, walking by sight, walking by flesh. How much faith have they got in God? I would say approximately nil, or even negative faith, if that's possible. They have no faith in God, no trust in God, just their bellies, their stomachs. And do they actually believe they've been taken out to die in the wilderness, or is that just an exaggeration they're making out of their frustration? Not sure, but I mean, they've seen God perform miracle after miracle after miracle, sign after sign after sign, and despite all of those signs, they're saying, he burns out here to kill us. I mean, that is provocative. You're God, you're just watching this lot and hearing the conversations and just thinking, you know, they really don't seem to get it at all, do they? Everything I've done for them, every time I've stepped in to protect them, to provide for them, to guard them, to lead them, and all I get is this accusation that I'm out to kill them. Whew, these people are really, really tough to deal with. But okay, God's going to respond positively. Verses 4 and 5, there's a solution. They're hungry. Well, okay. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. How do you do that? And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law, my Torah, my instruction, or not. It shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So it's going to get manna. We know a lot of the story here. So God says, okay, they're in the wilderness, they are hungry, they are complaining, I will bring down miraculously bread from heaven, you know, manna, and they'll go out and they'll get it every day for 6 days, and on 6 days they'll gather in twice as much. And that's going to be, you know, a real test for them. So that was the sort of third, I think, of the tests, when they murmured against Moses and complained that he'd brought them out to kill them. So God answers that. He's going to provide manna. But let's look at the fourth time they provoke God, which is to do with the manna, dropping down to verses 16 to 20. Same chapter, Exodus 16. The story moves forward a fraction. You heard it there. 6 days, go out and gather, right? That's the instruction for this miraculously provided food from heaven. Verses 16 to 20. Moses is talking to them and says, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person, according to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so, and gathered some more and some less. So off you go in the morning, and you'll see this manna, you know, lying on the ground, and you know, go and collect as much as you need for your household. So when they measured it by omers, verse 18, he who gathered much had nothing over, he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it till the morning. You've got to consume it the day you collect it. Got that? These are instructions from God. He's providing this miraculous bread from heaven. You go out and get as much as you need for your family. Do not preserve any of it till the following day. That's what verse 19 says. Let no one leave any of it till morning. You must consume it or dispose of it. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, or actually God. But some of them left part of it until morning, and of course it bred worms and stank, and Moses was angry with them, because this again is, you know, God's in the camp here. these are God's instructions, and they're just disobeying them. And why? Well, because, I'm reading between the lines here, they don't trust God to provide it the next day. If they trusted God that it would be there the next day, which is what God had said, then they would happily dispose of it on the day in question, and they'd get out of bed nice and early next morning, and off they go and collect some more. But of course, well, yeah, but you just never know what God's going to do. He says he'll send it tomorrow, but maybe he's going to kill us out here in the wilderness. Let's get plenty and store it up for tomorrow, just in case he doesn't turn up. So in reality, this is a lack of faith. It's relying on the physical, no reliance in God, no trust in God, don't see God's hand. I'll go purely by what I see, and I'll disobey God and rely on gathering up for myself, relying on myself. And of course it didn't work, because when you left it overnight, it bred worms and stank. And Moses found out, because I guess quite a few must have done this. Perhaps the stench was, you know, wafting about the camp, as lots of people decided that you can't trust this Jehovah being. Who knows what he's up to? I mean, you just can't trust him, can you? So therefore, let's store it up. Well, bad news, boys, that's just not going to go down well. So that was a fourth time they provoked God, annoyed God, publicly distrusted him. On to the fifth example, which is the same chapter, verses 23 to 29. So we're still in the manna story. 23, so far, you know, they've tried to keep it overnight despite being told not to, and that's because they, it would appear, don't trust God to deliver. Verse 23, then Moses said to them, this is what the Lord has said, tomorrow, so 6 days would have elapsed by now, tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Now remember, at this stage, this is Exodus 16, and the Ten Commandments weren't given to Exodus 20. So this is quite a while before the Ten Commandments, but the Sabbath was already in existence because, of course, it started back in Genesis. God, you know, renewed the face of the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested from all his work which he had made, and he blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. So the Sabbath, you know, long precedes Exodus 20, and here's an illustration of that. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, you know, Friday, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. This is different. Usually it would breed worms and stink, but actually on the Friday, you can get extra and lay it up until the Sabbath. Verse 24, so they laid it up till morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. So another miracle. Remember, the Sabbath is God's day. It's a special day. You're going to rest on that day. So keep the stuff from Friday. It will be preserved miraculously. Rest on the Sabbath. Verse 27. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather. Because who cares what this Jehovah being says? If it's out there, I'm going to go and get some, because you need what you can get in this life, and I'm going to get mine. And, go out 6 days, don't go the seventh day, to these ideas. But they found none, because God didn't send it, not when he's resting on his Sabbath. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? Now, this is provocative. You know, God's providing miraculous food day by day by day. He's preserving it miraculously over a Friday night into the Sabbath. He says, this is my holy Sabbath day, rest on it. And this bunch are out hunting for food to eat. And God says, this is just, rebellion. How long are you going to rebel against my commandments, my instructions, my laws? See, verse 29, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you in the 6 day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. And so the people, rested on the seventh day. But that's just sheer rebellion, simple disobedience over the Sabbath. And of course, there's a lesson clearly there for us too. So that was number five. So let's go into the sixth example where they really get up God's nose, and that's Exodus 17. So it's not taking very long, is it? It's almost like every chapter they're doing their best to provoke God to anger. Exodus 17, verses 1 to 7. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Now you might have thought, no problem. No problem at all. God has done so many miracles now for us, and the waters at Marah made fresh and exciting and sparkling and so on, and the manna day by day by day, and wow, there's no water here, but I mean, God delivers. You can trust Jehovah God. He's taking us to the promised land after all. He's delivered us from, tyranny and slavery in Egypt. We're God's people. Wow, I wonder how we'll do it now. Let's step back and just see what miracle takes place now. You might have thought that, but obviously that's not how it works. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord, or test the Lord, or provoke Jehovah?" And to contend means to argue, to quarrel, to get bitter, and that's what they're doing. They're not saying to Moses, "Moses, we understand that God is faithful, he is trustworthy. Only this morning we were eating, manna miraculously provided for us. Only two or three days ago we had a pleasant Sabbath rest, and the manna was preserved fresh overnight. And, we can see that God is with us and God is with you. How do you think we're going to get water here, Moses?" We're just, sort of curious because, we're very physical people and we're always a bit nervous and we're sorry about that. But, I think we're learning to trust God. But, how's it going to work here, Moses? But that's not what they did. It's argumentative. They're contending. They're aggressive. And Moses said, "Why are you arguing with me? I'm not God. Why do you tempt the Lord?" Because he's the one who's hearing these complaints. Verse 3, "And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, 'Why is it you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?'" Now, I don't know if that's exaggeration. I suspect they meant it. "You've taken us out here, right to the middle of the desert where there's nothing at all, to kill us with thirst." How cruel, how heartless. And it's quite obvious there is, at this stage, it would seem, absolutely zero faith in Jehovah. No matter what God does, it's never enough, is it? Verse 4, "So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me.'" And this is God's appointed. The people have seen so many miracles that you can lost count by now. And it seems, according to Moses, that they're about to pick up rocks and brain him. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel,'" the leaders. "Also, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink." Of course, how on earth does that work? How do you strike a huge boulder? And how do you get water to come pouring out of a boulder? It's another miracle. "And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the contention of the children of Israel, because they tempted the Lord, saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" So it seems the people actually said, "Is God with us? Is he for us? Is God here at all? Does Jehovah exist?" Which, bearing in mind everything that was taking place, including the daily manna, and the weekly Sabbath, and the waters at you know, the other place, at, and the Red Sea experience, and the 10 plagues in Egypt, is God with us or not? And really, that is so provocative. And so they call the name of the place Massa and Meribah. Massa means temptation, and Meribah can be translated provocation. So Moses actually called the place, this is the place of provocation, where you provoked God, where you tempted God, where you put God to the proof yet another time. And that's another, of course, fantastic miracle. And surely you're going to say that, well, at this stage, when this man Moses has gone up to a big rock, says the rock, and, you know, knocks on it, and, you know, millions of gallons of water, I guess, because there's potentially about 2+ million people, plus flocks and herds, all to be, you know, given water to drink and washing and so on. So we're talking about not just a little tiny stream standing there with your little sort of bucket, we're talking about lots of water coming out of a rock. I mean, fantastic. And surely, by now, that's it. Now the people, the penny has dropped, and they've realized that this God is for them, not against them, and they bow their heads in shame at the accusations they've made about God and about Moses, his servant. And now finally they've realized that God is for us. He's taking us to a wonderful place to live. How foolish of us to ever doubt him. Let's honor and worship this great Jehovah being. Yeah, right. No. Let's turn to Exodus 32. Read verses, well, a few of them, starting 1 to 6. So Exodus 32, we sort of jump over the Mount Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments. That was Exodus 20. And also around Exodus 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, you've got the covenant offered to ancient Israel, which they accepted. Yes, we would like to be your people and receive all these great blessings, and we will honor you and obey you. Of course we will. You can trust us, God. And, you know, Moses writes it all down, and there's a book of the covenant, and he takes blood and sprinkles it around. And that was the old covenant. And they're still there. They're still at Mount Sinai. They haven't moved away yet. They're still there because Moses is going back up the mountain for some more conversations with God to get more instructions. So they're still there, and the ink, so to speak, is still drying on the book of the covenant. And verse 1 of chapter 32. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, you know, sometimes there's a delay in, you know, God's plan or purpose, and you just have to be patient until the delay is over. But these people aren't very patient. Moses has been gone for a while. I think in total he was up here about 40 days. And so, you know, that's a few weeks. And they've got impatient. Yeah, where's Moses gone? What's happened to him? So the people gathered together to Aaron. The Hebrew can be translated, people gathered together against Aaron. I suspect that's probably more likely. You know, poor old Aaron's going to come under some pressure, and unfortunately poor old Aaron gives in to the pressure. So here come all these big bullies from Israel gathering together against Aaron and say to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Well, actually, guys, he's up talking to God, so get back in your place. That's what Aaron probably ought to have said. And Aaron said to them, oh, okay then. Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me. Aaron looks like he was a little bit on the sort of weak side, a bit intimidated by these big bullies. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, would this be provocative of you, O God, that this, you know, golden, you know, cow is supposed to be the hero that delivered you from the empire of Egypt? When Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. Aaron, and not a good move. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to Jehovah." Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, which are the ones you can eat. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Only they weren't playing chess or gin rummy. The Hebrew play apparently has got sexual connotations. And eating and drinking wasn't just having a nice little picnic. This was a feast to this golden calf. What brought us up out of the land of Egypt? The Good News Bible of verse 6 says, "The people sat down to a feast, which turned into an orgy of drinking and sex." Because these are Israelites, after all. But actually, don't forget, this is at the foot of Mount Sinai, where God is. And we're only days before they'd heard the Ten Commandments in God's own voice and entered into a covenant with that being. Verses 7 through 10. "And Jehovah said to Moses, 'Go, get down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves.'" Probably a bit unfair. Seems to me it was, you know, God's instructions, but anyway. "They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I have commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it." What was the first commandment? "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And the second one, "Don't make any graven image to bow down unto it." And this is like under God's very nose. "And said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people.'" You're telling me it is. "Now therefore, says God, 'let me alone, that I may my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And I'll make of you a great nation.'" That's it, Moses, get out of the way. I'm going to just blast them. And there's nothing you can do with this bunch. They are beyond redemption. I can't deal with them. They're just not going to cooperate. I'm just going to blow them out the way, and I'll start again with you. And that's what God, I think, intended. Some people say that was maybe just a little test to see whether Moses was, you know, big-headed enough to sort of say, "Oh, yeah, well, that's the way to go, God. Yeah, me, yeah, you're right. I'll be the super patriarch. Get on with it." But I think it was genuine. God says, just move out of the way. Their time is up. "But Moses pleaded with the Lord, his God, and said, 'Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought,'" let's get this straight, "'God, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power, and with a mighty hand. Why should the Egyptians speak and say, "He brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth"? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, 'I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've spoken of I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.' And so the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people." So I show you this sort of, you know, power that intercession sort of does have. So anyway, Moses grabs his stuff, heads off down the mountain in verse 19. "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing." Now, he knew it was happening, but, you know, things you hear, you know, have a mental picture. But now Moses gets down near the bottom and he actually sees it. You know, the sort of the drunkenness, the nakedness, the calf there with the sort of smoke of the sacrifices burning around it. And that's it. Moses blows his top. "So Moses' anger became hot and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain." That's the Ten Commandments that God wrote on these tablets of stone. "And he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, 'What did this people do to you that you brought so great a sin upon them?' And Aaron said, 'Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. They are just a bunch of absolute rogues. They're wicked, they're evil, Moses.'" Of course, is Aaron's brother. "You know they are. 'And they said to me, "Make us gods that shall go before us. For as Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." And I said to them, "Well, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me. I cast it into the fire, and would you believe it, Moses, out came this calf. It's just a miracle. I thought Aaron actually molded it, but anyway, gloss over that. When Moses saw the people were unrestrained, the King James says naked, the NET says running wild, so use your imagination. For Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, that Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, whoever is on the Lord's side, let him come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp, and let them every man kill his brother, his companion, every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. So there was some announcement about, obviously, the good guys come over here, the bad guys stay wherever you want to stay, and the Levites went through the land, through the camp, and killed 3,000. It's all, bad news. That party didn't end sort of too well. That's really provocative. There's some things, people are a bit physical, a bit carnal, and they can't get a drink of water, and they're whinging and complaining, it's not right. But this is like a separate level, isn't it? You're right under God's nose, just having received the Ten Commandments and entered into a covenant, and you've made a golden calf, and you're running around Starkers, having a wild party, and worshipping a golden calf. Woo! Dodgy one. Eighth. Time to provoke God appears to be Numbers chapter 10. Numbers 10, let's go to 33 and 34. There's not much detail given in this one. It's Numbers 10, 33 to 34, and then chapter 11, 1 to 3. Broken up in our Bibles, but it's all really one passage. Verse 33 of Numbers 10. So they depart from the mountain of the Lord, that's Mount Sinai, on a journey of 3 days. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was above them by day when they walked out from the camp. And so it was, whenever the Ark set out, that Moses said, rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered. Let those who hate you flee before you. And when it rested, he said, return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel. So this was, a daily occurrence. And the Ark of the Covenant would sort of go before them to, find out the best place to camp and so on. Verse 1 of chapter 11, verses 1 to 3 of chapter 11. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it and his anger was aroused. Now it doesn't tell us here exactly what they complained about. Possibly they were getting cheesed off because the journey was taking longer than they thought. Maybe they're getting very, just impatient. Maybe the territory was a bit too rough on them and their feet were sore. Either way, they were unhappy. And they were discontented. And they grumbled. And they complained about the journey and where they're going and when they're going to get there. What's God doing with us? And so God was very unhappy. Other translations, the Amplified says, and the people grumbled and deplored their hardships, and this was evil in the ears of the Lord. Or the Message says, the people fell to grumbling over their hard life. And, the Christian walk is not always the easiest of walks. Paul says, the sufferings of this present time shouldn't be compared to the glory that shall one day be revealed in us, but he accepts there are persecutions, there are difficulties. Life's not always easy. But that doesn't mean you start grumbling and, oh God, why are you doing this to me? Why are you taking me this way? What's this all about, God? I didn't sign up for this, God. Grumble, grumble, grumble. And that's what they did. And God's anger was aroused. So, because they were provoking him yet again. I say, we don't have the exact details here, but you can, again, read between the lines. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. So he called the name of the place Tabira, because of the fire of the Lord that burned among them. Well, remember, this is only about 3 or 4 days' walk from where 3,000 would get killed just earlier from their last provocation of God. So these people don't seem to learn lessons very quickly, do they? Well, no, they don't, Jamie, they don't. They're quite slow at learning. Let's go down to the ninth time they provoked God, Numbers 11, starting in verse 4. And reading through to verse 34, not all of them, but we start at verse 4 and end at verse 34 in Numbers 11. So this is the ninth time that they really get God's ire. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving, or I think the King James says fell a-lusting. This is the mixed multitude. You know, when Israel left Egypt, there were probably other groups there who were in slavery, hard-pressed. And I guess when Israel left and Egypt was partly destroyed, these other characters thought, well, we're not going to stay here either. Obviously, their God, this Jehovah being, is looking after these people and they're heading off to partly a very nice country. Let's go with them. So there was this mixed multitude. The Hebrew implies riffraff.
You know, I've got that
here. Mongrels. Who went with them were not, I mean, Israel was bad. As we've seen, Israelites were pretty bad, a pretty hard lot. The riffraff were riffer and raffer, and they went with them. And it says they fell a-lusting. Or here it says, yielded to intense craving. And so that really going to stir up, I mean, stirring up the Israelites. Well, you can imagine what that's going to bring you. So the children of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? These people, face it, you're never going to satisfy them, are you? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt. Oh, do you remember the fish? The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. Not to mention the slavery, and of course the whips and the boy babies been thrown into the Nile. You forget all that part. You know, that's your sort of false memories in a sense. You remember the good bits, but somehow blot out all the horrible bits. But now our whole being is dried up, nothing to eat, except there's manna, 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 every single soldier day, more manna, more manna, more manna. And so they were they complaining? Yes, they were complaining and lusting after meat. So drop down to verses 10. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Because, I mean, there's zero gratitude. There's zero faith. There's zero attempt to say, any chance, Moses, you could go to God and say, we'd like a little bit of variety here. They don't. They just mumble, just grumble, just complain. Of course, some of us do that. Sort of taking something to God and saying, God, I would really like, you know, something a bit different here. We just grumble and whinge and complain and murmur and mutter. And Moses also was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? What have I done? You know, why me? Why have I not found a favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them? And you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers. Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep all over me saying, give us meat, more meat, 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 meat. I can't bear all these people alone because their burden's too heavy for me. If you're going to treat me like this, well, kill me here and now. If I find favor in your sight, and don't let me see my wretchedness. I've had enough. It's too much. I can't take it. I want to die. And that's what Moses feels. You know, I'm suicidal. Can't take any more of this. Well, God's got a solution, of course. Verse 18. Say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you've wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt when we had, you know, Kentucky Fried Chickens and you know, McDonald's and Burger King and, you know, Denny's, and there was meat all over the shop. Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. A bit of a catch, of course. You shall eat not 1 day, nor 2 days, nor 5, nor 10, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you've despised the Lord who is among you. You have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt? God's plan, don't care. God's desire to bring us into a promised land, don't want to know. We want meat. We want meat. We want meat. And you can imagine what it's like. You've heard things like that on TV, you know, when the unions are out. We want this. We want this. And, you know, God's going to give it to them. Sort of, you know, big time. And Moses said, the people whom I am among are 600,000 men on foot. Yet you have said, I'll give them meat that they may eat for a whole month. Even Moses sort of like, you know, tilt. Where does this work? Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to provide enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together to give enough for them? And the Lord said to Moses, hey, hang on, buddy. Has the Lord's arm been shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will befall you or not. So even Moses is getting a wee bit, you know, losing some of the vision just by the sheer weight of these complainers, you know, day in and sort of day out, dropping down to verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side, a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. So I think what happens here is apparently there's migrations of quail along by the Sinai, and you get sort of millions of them in the air. And so what God apparently did was just you know, blew them across off their migratory path and dumped them all around the camp. And the people stayed up all that day, all that night, and all the next day, and gathered the quail. Now, hang on, you know, so 2 days and a night. How much quail do you want? Well, 1, 2, 10. And it says, he who gathered least gathered 10 homers. Now, I'm not quite sure how much a homer is, but somebody said it's sort of the burden a donkey would carry. So yeah. 10 homers means that every person's got a minimum of 10 donkey loads of a quail. And that's an awful lot of quail to be having. And spread them out for themselves. So what I think you've got, the vision here is really greed beyond comparison. These people are piled high with quail. Just greedy, 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 greedy. Again, anyway. And while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. One imagines there was a combination of, you know, overindulgence on the way, and I guess nobody ever asked a blessing on it. You might have thought, well, thank you, God in heaven, for my, you know, 10 donkey loads of quail. But I guess they just thought, let me get to it. Oh, meat, meat, meat. So possibly not even cooked properly, just, you know, tearing it apart. Unthankful, ungrateful. Well, you can guess. And God said, you know, cheeky lot. Kill a few while I'm at it. And he called the name of the place Kibroth Hataava, because they buried the people who had yielded to craving. So that was the 9th. Better move on, I can see there's a few minutes left here. But the 10th one, we sort of started earlier. The 10th and final, well, actually, of course, they provoked God many more times over the coming years. But this is leading up to the 10th. Of the 10 that was mentioned earlier. So Numbers 13, bringing us to the 10th time they provoked God, and the last time, the last time for now, I suppose I should say. Numbers 13, 1 to 3. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of the men who were heads of the children of Israel. The actual idea to send men out to spy the land was the people's. As God said, yeah, one per tribe. So God sort of limited it to one for each tribe sort of representative. But the idea of looking, spying out the land, was one that the people initiated. That was their idea. You have to wonder, really, you know, what's behind that? You know, God says, there's the land, go and take it. Well, no, let's send out some spies first to bring us back information. Moses seemed to be happy with that, although it was probably all a mistake. Verses 17 to 21. So Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, go up this way to the south, go up to the mountains, See what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities inhabited are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, whether there are forests there or not, and be of good courage. Oh, and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes. And that's probably, it seems, around about July or maybe August in the year. And of course they left Egypt at Passover time, you know, round about, let's say, early April. So it's only, April, May, June, July. It's only about 4 months or so since they left Egypt. It's not that long, really, in a sense. They're now by the borders of the Promised Land, and they're likely to enter, because they don't, but they should be entering in the next few weeks at one of the best times of the year, harvest time. You know, fruit everywhere. Perfect time to arrive, if they'd bothered. But, of course, they didn't. Verse 21, so they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob, near the entrance of Hamath. And of course, you know, they came back, and verse 26 says, they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron after 40 days, and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land, you know, a huge big cluster of grapes that they'd picked up en route. And they told them, said, we went to the land which you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Gorgeous, just like God said. It's a beautiful land, orchards and forests and the seaside and vineyards and milk and honey. The word of God is true. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified, very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, and you know what they're like. And the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Sherbetites, they're all over the place. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up with them said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. All the people whom we saw there are men of great stature, giants. There we saw the giants of the Nephilim, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So here's the promised land in harvest time, waiting for them, as per God's word and God's promise. And they're saying, we can't do it. We'll die. Verse 1 of chapter 14. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, oh, if only we had... They're back again. If only we had died in the land of Egypt. If only we had died in this wilderness. And this was really a step now too far. This was the end. You know, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And they that love it shall eat their fruit thereof. And they were, you know, God's listening. God's ready to bring them across the borders, across the Jordan, into the promised land. He's ready and willing and able. Why is the Lord, verse 3, brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? Who cares about God's plan? Who cares about this promised land? Who cares about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Who cares? Let's go back to slavery in Egypt. Or maybe they thought, because the empire was so damaged, they might go back to their homes and maybe, you know, run their own little enclave there. Who knows? But the promised land, forget it. God's plan, forget it. God's ideas, forget them. So they said to one another, verse 4, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. And verse 6, Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who spied out the land, tore their clothes. These were two of the 12 spies. They spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, look, the land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, and we know he does, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Because they can see what's happening here. This is direct provocation. This is rebellion against God and his purpose and plan. Do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. We don't like that word. Let's silence them. And so God said, that's it. Verse 22, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and here in the wilderness, time and time and time again, and have put me to the test, have provoked me now these 10 times, and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. Verse 27, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings which the children of Israel murmur against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, God's word is out to kill us, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have murmured against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you who are numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb and Joshua. Verse 31, but your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. And they did despise the land. It was there, God's promise, the promised land. But as for you, verse 32, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness. Verse 34, according to the number of the days in which you spied the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. You know, God is patient. None of us can afford to abuse his patience. You know, the saying often is, well, you can take the people out of Egypt, but you can't take Egypt out of the people. You can take people out of the world, but can you take the world out of people? You know, we've got to do what they didn't. You know, trust God, be thankful to God, walk by faith, not desire to return to our Egypt, you know, the world, and to keep on running our race, you know, with patience and endurance unto the end. That's what you and I should be doing, unlike, you know, these people. And it's not that God, in a sense, was super-duper angry and just lost his temper and jumped up and down and threw his toys out of the pram. I think reality is God just said, you know what, as perhaps the father talked to the son, these people will never do it. To take these people into the land when they've provoked us 10 times already and they've got no faith, no confidence, no trust, no belief, they don't see the vision, it's just not going to work. Let's just let them die in the next 40 years in the wilderness, and their children as they grow up, hopefully by the time they're ready, they'll have the faith and the confidence to at least, you know, go our way and obey us, and they can come in the next generation and have more faith than their fathers. So, unfortunately, most of those who left Egypt did not arrive in the promised land. Didn't walk by faith, didn't trust God. You know, God was able, but he does need people who will cooperate with him. And hopefully you and I can see the lessons for us today. We can all take heed. And from the examples recorded here for our benefit, and hopefully we can learn lessons from the wilderness. Okay, brethren, with that we'll conclude today's Bible study.